Chapter 5, The Bureaucracy. The federal government provides many services such as maintaining interstate highways, coordinating air traffic at airports, protecting borders, enforcing laws, and delivering mail. For each of these services, Congress has passed a law and created one or more executive branch departments or agencies to carry out the responsibilities of government. The federal bureaucracy is a vast hierarchical organization of executive branch employees, close to 3 million people, ranging from members of the President's Cabinet to accountants to the Internal Revenue Service, that takes care of the federal government's business. Within the bureaucracy are the men and women who serve the U.S. military, the largest group in the executive branch. Currently, the Federal Register, the federal government's official journal of regulations, proposed regulations, and public notices list 441 total executive branch entries that carry out the nation's business. Sometimes referred to as the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy is composed of experts with specialized roles and some with unique authority. These include soldiers, tax collectors, and letter carriers. Others are regulators and policymakers with unique authority but with questionable accountability. Additionally, personnel support the federal system from the private sector or as employees of state and local government who are paid with federal funds and guided by federal directives. The bureaucracy has grown from a four-man council and a few hundred employees at the nation's founding to a mass administration of expansive programs. George Washington established the first cabinet by appointing an attorney general and secretaries of state, treasury, and war. Congress created a military, a coast guard, and a postal system, thereby creating many quality federal jobs for President Washington to fill. As the nation has grown, so has its responsibilities. The bureaucracy has transitioned from an old board network system of political patronage to a professionalized institution with traits of specialization and some political neutrality. Today's bureaucracy is a product of 200 years of increased public expectation and increased federal responsibilities. The professionals who head the department agencies and their many subordinates carry out their tasks and responsibilities of government. They ensure the executive agenda and congressional mandates are implemented or followed. These bureaucrats and their government structures touch every issue involving the nation and provide countless services to U.S. citizens. Like all bureaucracies, such as those in large corporations and financial institutions, the federal bureaucracy is characterized by hierarchies, a distinct division of labor or specialization, and highly tailored roles. Federal bureaucrats include anyone in the executive branch carrying out some decision or applying some law. Bureaucrats sit on the president's cabinet, and they work in regional offices throughout the country. In fact, only 10% of federal workers are employed in Washington, D.C. Some bureaucrats are upper-level problem solvers and administrators. Others are lawyers, doctors, and educators. Still others are plumbers, carpenters, and drivers. Many lower-level bureaucrats must follow heavily scripted routines to assure consistency in government application of the law. Although employment in the federal bureaucracy uses a MERT system, presidents still name and campaign, still name friends and campaign managers to upper-level high White House jobs, as well as to cabinet and sub-cabinet positions that require Senate confirmation. President John F. Kennedy named his brother Robert as the nation's attorney general. Barack Obama brought with him from Chicago the city superintendent of schools to serve as the Secretary of Education. President Donald Trump named fellow New York financiers and Wall Street moguls to direct economic agencies. Most presidents appoint more than 2,000 upper-level management positions, deputy secretaries, and bureau chiefs who are the leaders and spokespeople for the executive branch. Many of these people tend to be in the president's party and have experience in relevant field of government or the private sector. The cabinet historically has been a place for political appointees, former senates, governors, and other elected officials accept cabinet posts when they lost re-election. Since the mid-1900s, the cabinet has become a place for academics, university presidents, and other experts. For example, President John Kennedy appointed Ford Motor Company CEO Robert McNamara as his Secretary of Defense. An old boy network of federal officers, mostly white males, dominates these upper-level posts. They tend to go in and out of government depending on which party controls the White House.
President Nixon's administration had sizable numbers of African-American appointees, especially in the more liberal agencies in which Nixon allowed directors to select sub-cabinet appointees. However, only 3% of Nixon's appointees were women. Nearly 20 years later, roughly 27% of the appointees of George H.W. Bush were women. Though upper-level executives tend to come from privileged backgrounds, it is no mystery then that the top-level appointees come from prestigious universities. Most fathers of presidential appointees had worked in managerial or professional jobs. Roughly 72% of the appointees have some postgraduate training and advanced degrees. Comparisons of top appointed federal officials with those in the top ranks of the private sector reveal that officials in government earn considerably lower salaries. Private sector leaders earned 15 to 16 times as much as their government counterparts. Department agency leaders are 50% more likely to have attended graduate school than top corporate executives, and they are 3 times as likely to have a PhD. When a new position is created, bureaucrats recommend it and recruit some of their own people who have experience in that area. This is called a name request job, a job for which those doing the hiring already have someone in mind. Additionally, a member of Congress will contribute to this process by recommending a colleague who can fit this position. According to the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, the federal workforce is diverse, and the demographics are similar to that of the overall labor force. However, as of 2014, there were about 14% more men than women. About a third of the federal employees were minorities, with African Americans making up the largest portion of these minority workers, and nearly 9% of the federal workers have a disability. Competitive service. The competitive service includes those merit-based jobs that require some type of exam or competitive hiring process. Foreign service officers, the State Department workers who represent the United States abroad, for example, must pass a challenging and competitive test. The expected service includes the non-tested jobs, providing hiring options when the competitive service is not practical. The ratio of competitive versus expected positions in the civilian bureaucracy has fluctuated with different laws and different presidents. In recent years, the two groups have been even. The executive hierarchy is a vast structure of governing bodies headed by these professional bureaucrats. They include departments, agencies, commissions, and a handful of private-public organizations known as government corporations. The president oversees the executive branch through a structured system of 15 departments. Newer departments include Energy, Veterans Affairs, and Homeland Security. Departments have been renamed and divided into multiple departments. The largest department is by far the Department of Defense. Each cabinet secretary directs a department. At formal cabinet meetings, the secretaries sit in seats based on the age of the department, with the oldest department seated closest to the president. Though different secretaries handle different issues and surely have different pressures and workloads, they are all paid the same salary. Agencies. The department contains agencies that divide the department's goals and workloads. In addition to the term agency, these subunits may be referred to as divisions, bureaus, offices, systems, administrations, and boards. The Department of Homeland Security houses the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Coast Guard, and the Transportation Security Administration. These agencies deal with protecting the country and its citizens. There are hundreds of agencies, many of which have headquarters in Washington, D.C., a regional offices in large U.S. cities. The president appoints the head of each agency, typically referred to as the director. Most directors serve under a president during a 4 or 8 year term. Some serve longer terms as defined in the statute that creates the agency. One of the most notable agencies is the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The Justice Department law enforcement agency first dealt with immigration violations, national banking and antitrust violations, then interstate crimes, transporting stolen property, bank robbery, and fraudulent schemes became federal crimes. Today, the FBI also works with state and local law enforcement to find America's most wanted criminals. The Bureau also helps to track and uncover terrorist organizations that threaten the United States. After Congress began to tax individual incomes, it then established an agency to collect the taxes. Originally named the Bureau of Internal Revenue, the Internal Revenue Service, the nation's tax collector within the Treasury Department, its mission is to help Americans understand and fulfill their tax responsibilities and to enforce the tax code fairly. With its criminal investigation division, the IRS also prosecutes those who evade their taxes. The statutes that create these bodies require that they are staffed fairly with the members of both major parties. Independent agencies and commissions. Cabinet agencies and purely executive agencies have one head. Independent agencies have a body that consists of 5 to 7 members. Members of these boards and commissions have staggered terms to ensure that the president cannot completely replace them with his own cronies. Such an action will make the agency and commissions politically rather than neutral. Government corporations are a hybrid of government agencies and a private company. These started to appear in 1930, and they usually come into being when the government wants to overlap with the private sector. Some examples of these government corporations are listed on the next page. When Congress creates the department, agencies, and the executive branch, it defines the organization's mission and empowers it to carry out the mission. The legislator gives the department board goals as they administer several agencies and a large number of bureaucrats within those departments. Agencies have a more specific goal, while the independent regulatory agencies have an even more unique responsibility in their own law enforcement mission and are protected by the bureaucrat structure and several notable Supreme Court decisions, including Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council. Writing and enforcing regulations. The legislation that creates and defines the department and agencies often gives wide latitude as to how they administer the law. Though all executive branch organizations have a degree of discretion in how they carry out the law, the independent regulator agencies and commissions have even greater leeway and power to shape and enforce natural policies. The laws that create and define these agencies are often vague, and the directors of these agencies and appointed officials who sit on their boards or commissions are more removed from political pressures than the head of departments and agencies that fall within the departments. Take, for example, the chief passage from the 1970 Clear Water Act that charged the Environmental Protection Agencies to enforce it. The nation's water should be free of pollutants in order to protect the health of our citizens and preserve natural habits. An individual or company shall not pollute the nation's water. If they do, they will be fined or jailed in accordance with the law. The EPA shall set pollution standards and shall have the authority to make rules necessary to carry out this act. Few of 535 legislators who helped pass this act are experts in the environmental science, so they delegate these authorities to the EPA and keep in contact with the agency to assure that this mission is accomplished.
Many additional independent agencies have a regulatory capacity. Congress has vested regulatory authority in agencies, commissions, and boards to oversee or regulate certain industries or concerns. They can make narrow industry-specific regulations, and they can adjudicate violators. In a sense, these executive branch bodies have powers normally held by the legislative and the judiciary. Like a court, the agencies, commissions, and boards within the bureaucracy can impose fines or other punishments. These administrative adjudications target industries or companies, not individual citizens. For example, the federal government collected civil penalties paid in connection with the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill, ranging from about $400 million fiscal year 2013 to about $160 million fiscal year 2016. One key aspect of enforcement is compliance monitoring. Make sure the firms and companies that are subject to industry regulations are following those standards and provisions. The Environmental Protection Agency monitors for compliance in several ways. assesses and documents compliance requiring permits for certain activities. It collects measurable scientific evidence by taking water or air samples near a factory to measure the amount of pollutants or emissions coming from the factory. After EPA decision or ruling, the agency checks whether those subjects to the ruling are following it. Officials and regulators of the EPA also go back to the rule writers about the successes or failures of the rules and procedures to either assert fairness in the further rules or to tie them up. Federal employees in the many departments, agencies, commissions, and boards within the bureaucracy are often experts in their field. For this reason, they frequently appear before congressional committees to provide expert testimony. For example, former FBI Director James Comey testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee in June of 2017 about matters related to his bureau investigation into Russian interference in the presidential election in 2016. In September 2017, Deputy Secretary of State John L. Sullivan testified before the House Committee on Foreign Affairs to discuss a redesign of the State Department. The Secretary of Veteran Affairs, the Honorable David J. Sullivan, MD, testified before the Senate Veteran Affairs Committees in the same month to address the problem of suicide among veterans. Over time, congressional committees and agencies become well acquainted. Lawmakers and leaders in the executive branch may have worked together in the past. At the same time, interest groups target agencies for pressing these agendas. Industry especially creates political action committees to impact policies and its success. These spectacle interests meet with and make donations to members of Congress as elections near. They also meet with bureaucrats during the rulemaking process in an ongoing effort to shape rules that affect them. The relationship among these three entities, an agency, a congressional committee, and an interest group is called an iron triangle because the... because the three interdependent relationships are so strong. The three points of the triangle join forces to create policy iron triangles, establish tight relationships that are collectively beneficial. Bureaucrats have an incentive to cooperate with congressional members who fund and direct them. Committee members have an incentive to pay attention to interest groups that reward them with PAC donations. Interest groups and agencies generally are out to advance similar goals from the start. Most recently, the scholars have observed the power and influence of issue networks. Issue networks include committee staffers, academics, think tanks, advocates, interest groups, and or members of media. These experts and stakeholders, sometimes at odds with one another or on matters unrelated to the issue they are addressing, collaborate to create specific policy on one issue. The policy-making web has grown because of so many overlapping issues, the proliferation of interest groups, and the influence of industry. Multiple actors and institutions interact to produce and implement possible policies. For the bureaucracy to do its job well, federal employees need to be professional, specialized, and politically neutral. Reforms over the years have helped create an environment in which those goals can be achieved. In the early days of the nation, the bureaucracy became a place to reward loyal party leaders with federal jobs, a practice known as patronage. When Jefferson took office in 1801, atop a developing party organization, for example, he filled every vacancy with a member of his party until achieving a balance of federalist and Jeffersonians. The growing impact of political parties called a rotation system of appointees regardless of merit or performance. The ongoing president's appointees left with him. On Andrew Jackson's inauguration day in 1829, job-hungry mobs pushed into the White House, snatching refreshments or as aggressively as they sought patronage jobs. Congressmen began recommending fellow party members and senators with their advice and consent power, asserted their influence on the process. The U.S. Post Office became the main agency for the president to run party machinery. Nearly every city has a branch office, is creating an established organizational hierarchy across the United States. Presidents appoint regional and local postmasters based on their efforts to help elect the president and with an exception of loyalty after the appointments. The patronage system became known as the spoil system. The Civil War and its aftermath brought an even greater need for bureaucracy, an enlarged federal staff, and ultimately an opportunity for corruption in government. By the 1870, the spoil system, including a high degree of nepotism, was thoroughly entrenched in the state and federal politics. The desire for the best government rather than the government of friends and families became a chief concern among certain groups and associations. Moral-based movements such as emancipation, temperance, and woman's suffrage also encouraged tampering or dismantling the spoil system. Reformers called for candidate appointments based on merit, skill, and experience. In 1870, Congress passed a law that authorized the president to create rules and regulations for civil service. The system, the law said, will best promote the efficiency thereof and ascertain the fitness of each candidate in respect to age, health, character, knowledge, and the ability. Reformers' efforts temporarily faded, however, until a murder of national consequence brought attention back to the issue. Soon after, James Garfield was sworn in as president in 1881, an eccentric named Charles Ingoont began insisting Garfield appointed him to a political office. Garfield denied his request. On July 2nd, only 3 months into president's term, Ingoont shot Garfield twice as he was about to board a train. Garfield lay wounded for months before he finally died. Garfield's assassination brought attention to the extreme case of patronage and encouraged more comprehensive legislation. Congress passed the Pendleton Civil Service Act in 1883 to prevent constant reward to loyal party members. The law ultimately created the merit system, which included competitive written exams for many job applicants. The law also created a bipartisan civil service commission to oversee the process and prevented officers from requiring federal employees to contribute to political campaigns. The establishment of the civil service and an attempt by the U.S. government during the industrial era to regulate the economy and care for the needy brought about the modern administrative state. The bureaucrat system became stocked with qualified experts dedicated to their federal jobs. The workers served across administrations to create continuity and expertise that professionalized the institution. The federal government began more frankly to legislate on business and corporations. In 1887, the government created its first regulatory commission, the Interstate Commerce Commission, to enforce federal law regarding train travel and products traveling across state lines. As the industrial age became the progressive era, the departments of commerce and law and labor were developed. Ostensibly at cross purposes, the Pure Food and Drug Act brought attention to the meat packaging industry and other industries producing consumable goods, and thus agencies were created to address these concerns. The 16th Amendment, which gave Congress the power to collect taxes on income, put more money into treasury coffers, which helped the federal bureaucracy expand. Over the next several decades, the United States survived two world wars and an economic depression that resulted into an entirely new view of government's administrative role. New Deal programs of the 1930s gave the government more responsibility and worked to strengthen the Democrat Party in ways that the Pendleton Act was meant to prevent. The Pendleton placed only a segment of the federal civilian workforce under the examination system. Leading federal office holders across the country were still wrapped up in politics. At the 1936 Democrat National Convention, a majority of delegates were postmasters, U.S. Marshals, revenue collectors, or close relatives. Republicans joined reform-minded Democrats to create another regulation meant to curb the overlap of politics and profession. Congress passed statutes in 1939 and 1940 that are collectively referred to as the Hatch Act. Sponsored by Democrat Senator Carl Hatch of New Mexico, the laws distanced federal employees as well as state employees paid with federal funds from politics. It prohibits federal workers from becoming directly involved in federal political campaigns. The law, however, interfered with the First Amendment rights of free speech and free association. The Hatch Act was criticized on these grounds and was eventually softened by the Federal Employees Political Activities Act of 1993. Today, federal employees cannot use their official position to influence or interfere in an election. They cannot engage in political activity while on duty, while using a government vehicle, or while in official uniform. They can, however, express opinions about candidates, contribute to a campaign fund, join political parties, and attend political functions after hours. And the 1960 laws that ensured the equal rights of minorities and women brought on the need for new offices to guarantee them. The Justice Department established the Office of Civil Rights and later the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. A push for consumer rights and product safety led Congress to create the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Concerns for clear air and water brought about the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency. President Jimmy Carter ran for office in 1976, promising to change Washington and to reform the bureaucracy. With experience as an engineer and as a governor, he spent much time as analyzing systems. He tinkered with the structure of the federal government as much as any other president. What became the Civil Service Reform Act altered how a bureaucrat is dismissed, limited preferences for veterans in hope of balancing the genders in federal employment, and put upper-level appointments back into the president's hand. The law also created a senior executive service, a system that placed more emphasis on the bureaucrat's skills and experience than on the job. The administration paid the recruited and incoming senior executives a standard salary, but the president had the right to move these officials laterally or put them in a lesser job with no loss of pay. Congress reforms increased managerial flexibility and gave political leaders the tools to carve and mold the senior executive service. Office of Personnel Management, the Civil Service Commission, established by the Pendleton Act, operated until the 1978 reforms, replaced it with the Office of Personnel Management. The OPM runs the MERT system and coordinates the federal application process for jobs and hiring. The OPM's goal includes promoting the ideals of public service, finding the best people for federal jobs, and preserving MERT system principles, meaning the larger, more established agencies do their own hiring.
Much as local police chief might instruct their officers on how to enforce speed limits or jaywalking, federal executive branch officers can shape the enforcement of policy through instruction, directives, and personal interpretation of the laws. They have this power through the delegation of discretionary authority. Congress has granted departments, agencies, bureaus, and commissions, staffed with experts in their field, varying degrees of discretion in developing rules and interpreting litigation. The constitutional bias for bureaucratic departments or agencies stems from Congress' power to create and empower them. Congress also guides and funds them. The legislative branch decides on the board principles for law. The details emerge during debate over policies. However, Congress leaves the specific regulations for implementing the policy up to the members of bureaucracy. Depending on its discretionary authority, any executive branch agency might have the power and influence to make decisions and to take or not to take courses of action. Congress has given the executive branch significant authority in three ways. By 1. Creating agencies to pay subsidies to groups such as farmers or Social Security recipients. 2. Creating a system to distribute federal dollars going to the states, such as grant programs. And 3. Giving many federal offices the ability to devise and enforce regulations for various industries or issues. The legislative power enables the federal communications commissions, for example, to determine what is indecent for televised broadcasts and enables the EPA to define factory emission standards. As laws are made in public manner, the agency rulemaking process and schedule must also be available to the public in advance to allow relevant players to participate in the process. Company representatives or concerned citizens can submit arguments or paper and testify before commission, much as an expert might appear before the congressional committee. Perhaps more familiar are the rules established by the Transportation Security Administration, the agency in the Department of Homeland Security that monitors passengers boarding airplanes, who will be searched and how. These procedures change from time to time as the government finds new reasons to ban certain items from flights or to soften and overlay strict lists. The chief lawmaking body, Congress, which is complex lawmaking procedures and necessary depths, cannot keep up with the day-to-day changes in policies and procedures, so it entrusts a TSA monitor the airplanes and empower it to make rules to keep passengers safe. In addition to rulemaking departments and agencies, in the federal bureaucracy have latitude in interpreting policy. For example, Security of Homeland Security Janet Napolitan issued a directive declaring that agencies in her department would neither arrest nor deport illegal immigrants who had come into the United States as children. Those covered under the proposed Development, Relief, and Education of Alien Minors Act. She issued the directive with the full support of her boss, President Obama, yet her delegation brought a firestorm of controversy. Was this in violation of basic law? Ain't undocumented immigrants illegal regardless of how old they were upon entering the U.S.? Like the local police chief who suggested not ticketing motorists driving a mere 2 miles over the speed limit, the president and his departments can enforce the law with some discretion, as Napolitan and Obama demonstrated with the Dreamers. In a similar way, in 2013, Attorney General Eric Holder announced the Obama administration's revised approach to enforcing marijuana violations. In doing so, he did not rewrite the law. Holder did, however, declare that the Justice Department would not use federal resources to crack down on selling or using the drug in states where voters had democratically deemed marijuana illegal. During the Trump administration, the Department of Justice under Attorney Jeff Sessions declared that local U.S. attorneys, those presidential appointed prosecutors, will bring federal crime cases to court in their districts across the country, shall be the local determiners on how federal marijuana policy is handled. In fact, the Justice Department attorneys and the FBI deal with a variety of federal crimes on a daily basis and decide whether to prosecute and which crimes are higher on their property list. Priority list. This inconsistency from administration to administration may be confusing and destabilizing to some, but it is an inevitable element of administration discretion. It is often difficult to determine who is ultimately responsible for any bureaucratic decision. Congress creates the big picture laws and some of the regulations. The president shapes the departments and agencies when appointing cabinet secretaries and agency directors who are discretionary. Authority. Challenges to department directives and agency ruling come in the courts, which may be upheld or overruled. The executive branch body, while interest groups and industry try to influence regulations and their enforcement. With so many players interacting with these executive branch subunits, it is difficult to tell to whom the bureau's administrations and offices are beholden. Also, in trying to follow prescribed law, these executive branch bodies still face political constraints and challenges despite their discretionary latitude. Cabinet secretaries serve at the pleasure of the president, but have to please many people, including to some degree their subordinates and staff in the field carrying out the law. These secretaries and their employees report to Congress and thus must please legislative members, especially for funds. The bureaucracy's discretion is in rulemaking authority raises many questions. Does it violate the separation of power doctrine? How democratic is it for a handful of experts to create rules and that entire industries must follow? Is due process followed when an agency finds an individual or a company for violating a policy for which no elected representative voted and on which no American court ruled? In part to address these questions, Congress passed the Administrative Procedures Act in 1946 to better guide agencies in developing their policies. The APA asserts that those who will be governed by a policy can have input into shaping it. There must be a notice and commitment, opportunity for citizens to voice concerns about proposed regulations. Committee hearing. Congress also has a responsibility to assure that agencies and departments charged with carrying out the ideas in the law are in fact doing so, and doing so fairly. Congressional oversight is essentially a check and balance on the agencies themselves and over the president's influence of them. While some regulatory House and Senate committees hold oversight hearings to address agency action, interaction, or their relationship with the agency, the list of standing House and Senate committees parallels a list of notable agencies. For example, the House Committee on Homeland Security has jurisdiction over the department of the same name. The Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry oversees the National Park Service, which is part of the Department of Interior. Committees and subcommittees receive reports from directors and call the directors to testify. Cabinet Securities Agency directors and other ranking bureaucrats testify before the relevant committee. Sometimes these are routine and collegial encounters that allow for the agency or department to update Congress on how it is doing, what goals it has accomplished, or what plans they may have. At other times, the committee with authority will call a hearing to get to the bottom of a thorny issue. A few years ago, for example, the Veterans Affairs Department showed some serious mismanagement and failures in its quest to serve U.S. military. Veterans. Primary among the allegations were long wait times at VA hospitals to get medical attention and bureaucrats' falsely records. One report alleged that the average wait time for an appointment was 115 days. The poorly organized operation resulted in a congressional investigation of the department and the resignation of the Veterans Affairs Secretary. Power of the purpose. In addition to general oversight, Congress determines how much funding these organizations receive. Ask top-level bureaucrats how they can improve their goals and sometimes tries to constrain agencies. With the power of the purse, Congress can determine the financial state of agencies and its success when it allocates money. The agency cannot spend public funds until a committee or subcommittee first passes authorization of spending measures. These measures state the maximum amount the agency can spend on certain programs. The distribution of money defined in such an authorization may be a one-time allotment of funds, or it could be a recurring annual allotment. The agency will not receive the actual funds until each House Appropriations Committee and the full chamber also approve the spending. These appropriations are typically made annually as part of a federal budget. A few agencies do not require a congressional appropriation. The Federal Reserve Board actually makes money through its system of charging interest to commercial banks. The Postal Service is also self-sufficient. Others charge fees and fines that supplement their operating costs. These agencies are a little less beholden to Congress, at least when it comes to asking for money. The final say, Congress and agencies share a good deal of authority. This sharing has created an unclear area of jurisdiction. One procedure that has developed to sort out any overlap is committee clearance. Some congressional committees have secured the authority to review and approve certain agency actions in advance. Few executive branch leaders will ignore the actions the congressional committee requests, knowing the same committee determines its funding. Congress established the legislative veto in the 1930s to control executive agencies. The legislative veto is a requirement that certain agency decisions must wait for a defined period of either 30 or 90 days. During the conflict in Vietnam, Congress used a legislative veto to put some limits on the deployment of military activity. But the public interest groups that had fought to create regulatory agencies in the 1960s watched agencies' lawful decisions being stopped by one or the other House of Congress. So when the opportunity arose for a case challenging the constitutional or the legislative veto, public citizen, a group advocating for citizen protections and separation of powers, uses litigation services to eventually bring it before the Supreme Court. The case entered on Jagdish Chadhad, born in British-controlled Kenya, who immigrated to the United States in the 1960s to study. When his U.S. visa expired, neither Britain nor Kenya, which had gained independence from Britain in 1963, would accept him. So he applied for permanent residency in the United States. The Immigration and Naturalization Service approved his application. 2 years later, the House rejected it through a legislative veto. Chad had sued to retain his U.S. residency. Chad Ha. Fight to remain in the United States became a power play between the president and Congress over the constitutional or the legislative veto. In INS versus Chadha, the Supreme Court sided with Chadha and against Congress's use of this procedure. The veto was intended only for the president, not the legislative branch. The court stated that when the House rejected Chadha's application, it exercised a judicial function by expressing its opinions on the application of a law, something reserved for the courts. The court ruled against Congress's use of the legislative veto as a violation of separation of powers. Since then, informal compromises between agencies and congressional committees have proven successful in working out differences. Departments and agencies must compete with others for funding and for the president's ear. Similar departments and agencies have overlapping goals. They all contend that with more money they could better compete their missions. At the same time, the president asserts authority and influence to make sure the executive ideology is carried out in policy. Though the regulatory review process administered through the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, all regulations that have symphonic effect on the economy, public health, and other major aspects of policy undergo close review. Any regulations that conflict with the president's agenda must be questioned, revised, and even eliminated. In 2017, during the Trump administration, the Federal Communications Commission rolled back the regulations covering oversight of internet providers, often referred to as net neutrality. This rollback lifted regulations from the Obama administration that required cable and telecommunications companies to treat all web traffic equally. The deregulation was part of President Trump's ideology, as in other areas he called for the government to reduce regulation on business so that businesses can grow and prosper in a freer marketplace. Competition. The different beliefs or approaches of executive departments can create friction between them when the United States must state a position or make a decision. The Departments of State and Defense, for example, have had differences on foreign policy. The Department of State is the diplomatic wing of the government, and Department of Defense trains the military and prepares the country for armed conflict. These differing prospects can make the development of cohort goals and challenging. Law enforcement agencies sometimes cooperate to find criminals, but they are also protective of their methods and desire credit in a way that breeds discretion. The lack of information sharing among the government's many intelligence agencies before September 11 likely increased the terrorist chances of a successful and unexpected attack. Sometimes upper-level bureaucrats get caught between their boss and the many people who work for them. The president's policy goals may take into account some of the practical constraints of the bureaucracy, as a result may be too difficult to achieve. An appointed bureaucrat may therefore go native by siding with his or her own department or agency instead of with the department. Going native is a risky proportion, and many who have publicly disagreed with the president have been replaced. Presidents have at times rotated appointees from agency to agency to assure loyalty to administration. Federal employees sometimes see corruption or infiltration in their offices but are tempted to keep quiet. Exposing illegal or improper government activities can lead to response from those in the organization or retaliation that can lead to their termination. However, citizens in a democracy want transparency, and government often encourages such exposure. That is why Congress passed the Whistleblower Protection Act in 1989, which prohibits a federal agency from retaliating or threatening an employee from disclosing acts that he or she believes were illegal or dishonest. Presidential goals and streamlining. The bureaucracy can be either an impediment or a vehicle for fulfilling presidential goals. When the bureaucracy works against or impedes the administration's ideas and goals, presidents are encouraged to shake up or restructure the system. Presidents have used both their formal powers, such as the power to appoint officials, and their informal powers, such as persuasion and leadership, to make the bureaucracy work for the executive agenda. Presidents have also tried to curb bureaucrat waste. President Ronald Reagan, who arrived in Washington in 1981, stated in his inaugural address, "Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem." To gain greater control over departments and agencies, he put people who agreed with the Reagan agenda into top positions. He sought officials who would show loyalty to the White House and reduce administration personnel. President Clinton promised in his administration to address government efficiency. However, he used a more careful tone than his procedures did, conveying that problems in a large administration came not from bureaucrats, but rather from the outdated systems and inefficient institutions. His vice president, Al Gore, headed the effort to investigate and revamp the administration. The Clinton-Gore team signaled that the administration was doing something to make government work better and cost less. The president ultimately promised to reinvent rather than dismantle the bureaucracy system. In 1993, Clinton announced a six-month review of the federal government. The National Performance Review became Clinton's key document in assessing the federal bureaucracy. The review was organized to identify problems and offer solutions and ideas for government savings. The group focused on diminishing the paperwork burden and placing more discretionary responsibility with the agencies. The report made almost 400 recommendations designed to cut red tape, put customers first, empower employees, and produce better and less expensive government. One report, From Red Tape to Results, characterized the federal government as an industrial era structure operating in the information age. The bureaucracy had become so inundated with rules and procedures, so constrained by red tape, that it could not perform the way Congress had intended. The review differed from prior ones that had sought to increase efficiency, accountability, and consistency. The NPR review pushed for the greater customer satisfaction and more business-like manner of running government. Clinton, by way of executive order, also told heads of executive agencies to expand flex options so federal workers could better balance the demands of job and family. Bureaucrat agencies interact with courts in a variety of ways. The implementation of some rules can result in the prosecution of an offender and in a criminal trial. Agency fines and punishments can be appealed in federal court, and the U.S. Supreme Court has shaped how Congress can interact with agencies and how general empowered the agencies with wider latitude to enact their missions. Some would say as it has been to democratically develop policy and the rights of industry.
courts and accountability. The courts are involved when citizens challenge federal bureaucrat decisions. Because agency actions are not always constitutional, fair, or practical, individuals have the right of due process and review of the law. The judicial review, writes one scholar, serves as a check on lawlessness, a check on administration agents making choices based on their convenient personal or political preferences without substantial concern for matters of inconvenient principle. Before an individual may claim harm by department action or a company claim adverse events efforts by a regulatory agency, the complaints must first go through a required multi-step review process. The Administration Procedures Act defines the procedure, but it differs by agency across the federal hierarchy, including the relevant review boards and adjudication process. Once the appeal process is fully exhausted, a court might consider a challenge by the allegedly injured party. A detailed record of the agency action and the review process up to this point reveal the substance of the policy and most relevant facts. The court uses this record to determine whether the law has been followed and whether the agency acted within reason. U.S. Circuit Courts of Appeals. Most judicial hearing challenges, agency decisions, and regulatory punishments are looking for a complicated interpretation of the law, its application, or its constitutional. These are concerns for appeals courts. When Justin Timberlake accidentally exposed Janet Jackson's breasts during the 2004 Super Bowl halftime show on a live CBS television broadcast, the Federal Communications Commission got involved because of the concerns that the broadcast decisioning rules have been violated. The FCC punished Van Koom, the CBS parent company. The standard indecency fine of this type, 27,500 times the number of affiliates to broadcast the show. It added up to 550,000. The network's lawyers challenged the ruling in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. The federal court overruled the FCC and sided with the CBS Viacom. However, over the last few decades, although these appeals courts have had the power to hold bureaucrat agencies accountable, they have acted as less as a check of executive authority and more as an enabler of it. U.S. courts of appeals have increased the number of cases they take, as the bureaucracy has generally grown in size and authority. The Supreme Court simply does not take many cases when they appealed from the circuit courts, so the courts of the appeals have largely become the final arbiter of agency decisions. These court decisions and most of the rare cases the Supreme Court hears tend to uphold the idea that unless agency's discretion is blatantly unlawful or abusive, deference should go to the agency. Two principles, the substantial evidence doctrine and the arbitrary, the capricious test, have governed their ruling. This is unless the appealing party can provide substantial evidence that the agency has gone far afield of the law or damaged the party outside of this law. The agency should be permitted to govern under its enabling statute. And if the agency is applying the law equally and consistently, it should be allowed to do so. The fundamental support for this approach is that the People's Branch Congress has enabled the agency and the bureaucrats making the decisions are experts in the field, and within the federal courts examine these disputes. They focus more on the decision-making procedures than the substance of the rules or decisions. When the Third Circuit Court overruled the FCC in the Super Bowl controversy, it did so in part by following standards of consistency. The FCC had ruled that fleeting indiscrepancy, that is accidental and intentionally indecency, usually in the form of verbal slips, have not been punished in the past. How could the FCC now instate an ex post facto policy that, when compared with prior decisions, went the other way? Trends. Appeals courts are more likely to protect and uphold independent regulatory agency decisions than general executive branch department and agency decisions. One study found that lower federal courts upheld the agency's decisions and punishments by
76% of the time. Another found the Supreme Court upheld challenges to these executive branch decisions 91% of the time. The standard. The Supreme Court has yielded to bureaucrat authority when the challenge in the statute that defines their authority is vague. In other words, when Congress bestows powers on an entity, it creates but has perhaps failed to explicitly define scenarios or rulings that the agency might make. The court recommends on this erring on the side of bureaucracy. The pyramid case that governs this approach is Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, decided in 1984. The case pitted Chevron Oil against an environmental protection group, but the real question was to what degree an agency can set industry standards when the law governing the power is incomplete or vague. The Clear Air Act of 1970 required states to create permit programs for any new or modified plants that might affect air pollution. The EPA passed a regulation that grouped these plants into a geographic bubble area for pollution measurement, creating the possibility that some plants would not need a permit if the modification would not affect the overall impact on the defined bubble. The NRDC challenged the EPA procedure in order to protect the air. The District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals set aside the EPA regulation and Chevron appealed. The Supreme Court overruled the D.C. Circuit Court and established the Chevron doctrine, under which courts are supposed to defer to agencies when laws defining their responsibilities are vague or ambiguous. Under the Chevron concept, agencies can not only determine what the law is, they can also change that interpretation at any time. Efficiency. The only thing that saves us from bureaucracy is efficiency, said Ingram McArthy, a Minnesota Democrat who served in the House and Senate from 1949 to 1971. Indeed, the structure, rules, and overlapping jurisdictions seem inevitable byproduct of government. These qualities of bureaucracy have led to some cumbersome challenges for citizens, policymakers, and bureaucrats themselves. Duplication. Congress has a tough time establishing clear laws and clear goals. As a result, it creates multiple instances to manage or oversee important agencies with only managerial differences. It is a rare agency that has exclusive authority over a particular responsibility. For example, both the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration seek to apprehend drug dealers. Both the Army and the Navy provide military protection, while the CIA and the National Security Agency seek foreign intelligence. This kind of duplication creates competition among agencies and causes jurisdictional issues. This also creates redundancy that expands government costs and frustrates taxpayers, because two or more agencies that overlap responsibilities might handle matters differently. The very specific rules of dealing with the government can slow things down. Red tape. The most common complaint among U.S. citizens about government is red tape. Red tape is the vast amount of paperwork, procedures, forms, and formal steps citizens must take to accomplish a government-mandated task. Any driver who has stood in line at a local bureau of motor vehicles with proof of insurance, an emissions check, and the other paperwork to receive a driver's license can understand red tape.
Governmental restrictions on agencies' decisions and purchases contribute to slowing down bureaucratic decision making. In many cases, agencies must meet contingencies before they can move ahead with projects. For example, Congress mandates that government contracts must be with American firms. The federal government institutes targets and guidelines to encourage companies to work with minority-owned businesses. Agreements dictate that the federal government hire firms supporting unions and pay prevailing wages. Major construction firms require environmental and economic impact studies to determine the project's effect on the location. Accountability. Another concern for the operation of the bureaucracy is accountability. Presidents and their subordinates have ordered performance reviews and assessments for decades, trying to enhance responsiveness and effectiveness while also seeking to boost efficiency can be a counterproductive. A government of laws is one that avoids obscurity or capricious rule.
But the more an agency is held accountable, the more forms, guidelines, and systems are required. Accountability, therefore, increases red tape and decreases responsiveness. For example, the Paperwork Reduction Act of 1979, one of President Jimmy Carter's reforms, sounded like a good idea when it was proposed. To enforce it, Congress created the Office of Internal Regulatory Affairs, which created numerous obstacles for agencies issuing regulations. It decreased the flow of paper by increasing regulations on the federal bureaucracy itself. Bashing bureaucrats have been fashionable for decades. Outspoken Alabama Governor George Wallace, who served in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, was known for attacking the pointy-headed bureaucrats. Presidents Nixon, Carter, and Reagan taught the American public to distrust them. The bureaucracy has become a favorite scapegoat of politicians promising to reform government, largely because so many people had negative experiences with red tape. Politicians and commenters have primed citizens to focus their reassessments on the amorphous, faceless entity. Despite the fact that most citizens desire the government services that agencies offer and tend to seek positively about individual bureaucrats they have encountered.